politics, the bush, and the future of our regions. You're listening to Weatherboard and Iron with Barnaby Joyce and Matt Canavan.
Welcome to the first episode of Weatherboard and Iron. I'm Senator Matt Canavan. I'm joined here by former Senator Barnaby Joyce, member for New England. G'day, mate. How you going?
Well, it's great to have time to have a discussion with the Australian people. I suppose it's a good idea of yours, Matt, and Weatherboard and Iron. People always say Weatherboard and Iron, thinking it's some new handicap in golf, or maybe it's a new band, some country music band. No, it's Weatherboard and Iron, which is a type of a house, iron roof, and weatherboard exterior.
Yeah, well, it sort of represents our constituency, and I do have more time now, thanks to you, Barnaby. So I thought I'd better make myself productive, and you know, we'll see how we go today, having a chat about a few issues. But maybe talk a bit more about, like, I've heard you say Weatherboard and Iron lots of times. I think it was news to the media a couple of years ago. You sort of explained your decision just about what you're about. But, like, I suppose where were the people in those Weatherboard Nines? They're the people we represent. So what is that? What are they? Who are they, and why are we here sort of trying to do stuff for them?
Well, I probably try to encapsulate it a bit in the book where I said, you know, if you're trying to find a metaphor for what a political party should represent, then, you know, you've got to have something that's manifestly expresses something that people can recognise. Now, I have great respect for, you know, the Republicans, and the Republicans have got the elephant, you know, the big and strong, and the Democrats have got their donkey, efficient, you know, small and efficient. I don't think they are, though. But the centre of the Australian psyche, I believe, is people's house. That's it. It is so exemplary as what Australians strive to do. They want to pay it off. They want to live in it. It's the essence of their old age retirement. It's everything about it. It's where their kids grow up. It's seminal in the creation of who you are. And we have to recognise that the people who vote for the National Party are probably not living on Sydney Harbour. They might, but they're probably not. They live in those small towns. And in those towns, you will see a great abundance of houses with corrugated iron roofs and weatherboard walls, timber walls. And they're proud of them. They keep the gardens neat. They prune their roses. They're proud of their car. They're proud of their nation. But they're probably doing it slightly tougher than other people. And we have to recognise that. And every day we spend here, we've got to be bold enough and bolshy enough to get the outcomes that they need, and to put yourself in a position where you can get the outcomes they need.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I was just looking the other day at the statistics from the last election. The Australian National University has a big survey after every election of voters around the country, asked people a heap, a bevy of questions, one of which is how much income you're on and who you voted for. So then you can look at, what are the average incomes of different voters for different political parties. You know, a lot of people would, I think if you ask them who represents the poorest people in the community, they'd answer the Labor Party, because, you know, they've traditionally looked after, said they look after the working class, those on welfare, etc. But it's not the case. It's not the case. Those with the lowest average incomes, the voters with the lowest average incomes are the Nationals Party.
Yep.
The Labor Party's just ahead of us. And then the Liberal Party's next, and the Greens. They've got the highest incomes of all Greens voters, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, you're right about that house, right? Like you know, I didn't grow up in the bush myself. I grew up in the suburbs, but my wife and I, we saved so hard to get our first home. And it's one of the best days of my life, getting the keys, walking home, you've got no furniture, but it's yours, right? You got this palpable feeling that this is mine. I can do what I want with it. I can keep people out of it. I can build a family in it and take control of it. And, you know, that's that desire, I think, I mean, not just in Australia, but certainly from our constituents here. They want us to be able to provide an environment that gives them control over their own lives, their own futures, make mistakes, reap the benefits of good decisions without, whether it's big business, big unions, big government trying to direct their lives.
Yeah, well, the first house I bought with Natalie was at 31 Gordon Street, Werris Creek. It was a weatherboard and iron house. And we were very, very proud of it, you know, and it cost us $69,000. Actually, correction, cost us $73,000. And I really rode that bull market because when I sold it for $69,000. But it came with a shed to do your work on your motor vehicle in. It came with the house was neat and tidy. I was happy. That was a representation of my life. And, you know, that's and later on in St. George, and you know, it was another Weatherboard 9. I remember renovating it and thinking, you know, this is a representation of my life. And that's
maybe you're trying to sell it to me one time and it became a sandy. You tried, don't give up your day job.
I tried to do that. There was the accountant side of my nature. And you were from out of town.
Yeah.
But it was very close to the pub if you wanted to go there.
Yeah. Next door.
The sequel is my book is Weatherboard and Iron and Pub. But and I think that what you say there, you got to understand the life of the person inside that. For people in the Weatherboard and Iron, it is unlikely that they were born into greater affluence. You will not see them in whatever it is, the Brutes or whatever the book about the lineage of people. You won't find them in that. They probably weren't ahead of you at Oxford or Cambridge or Sydney University. They haven't got huge bank balances. So you've got to say, what is the mechanism that we have to bring these people ahead in life? And it is this. A person who is born without great wealth, without a great education, without being the beneficiary of a prominent or strong family, is going to get ahead in life basically by their own endeavours. So our job is to help a person to transcend through the economic and social stratification of life to their highest level, limited only by their innate ability. And the things that are proscribe that is rule things out, big government, big unions, excessive regulation, because people ultimately want to be free. And to be free, you have to have as much control over your life as possible. That is not walk around in the corporate uniform, following the corporate manual, abiding by the corporate guidelines, but actually determining your own destiny. And where does that happen overwhelmingly? In small business. And someone's got to be allowed to get into a small business to get into big business. I find the problem down here, a lot of times people just don't really know why they're in this building. If you actually said to them, mate, what on earth do you really believe in? They'd say, good government. You say, well, what the hell does that mean? What is that? That's a word. What does it mean? You know, what is the thing that sits under that, rests under that, that drives you to be a pain in the ass, that drives you to drive agendas? What is it all about? You know, it's, you know,
it frustrates me to me too, because I don't understand if you didn't have that driving passion, you know, desire to do something, why you do this job? I mean, you spend so much time away from your family. Yes. I'm not complaining. It's a great job, but it's a sacrifice at times. It's a sacrifice I willingly pay, and I'm fortunate enough to have a wife that supports me 100%. But the corresponding benefit is, you know, you get sick of the cars and the hotels and flights very quickly. It's that you can make a difference. You know, you can deliver something, you can deliver change. Sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. But, you know, we work together on the effects test. Got that change competition law. Yep. You've made other changes to competition law in the past. Better for small business, protecting them.
Country of origin labeling.
Massive fight on a Darney. We've got that mine going. And, we're starting to build dams.
Inland rail.
So, regional, you know, hopefully in 20, 30 years, my kids might be a bit frustrated and spend more time with them, but I can drive down to Carmichael and show them, this is something I help do. So,
well, better than that, what you'd be able to do is you'd be able to drive down around there and drive into a town and say, see that family's house, that fellow's house, that lady's house. The reason they got that house, they paid for that house. The reason they got the money to pay for that house, they worked in this mine. And that means that family had the opportunity to live at that style of life with the kids in the backyard, sending the kids off to the local Catholic school or state school. And they did that because they actually made a buck. And I drove that because people's alternate view was that they had to be poor. Mm. And the enemy of the National Party are people who want to keep you poor.
That's right. Yeah, we want to give people a chance to get ahead. And one thing I want to pick you up on, we'll probably talk about another episode, is you said your first home was 69,000.
You were 73, I think.
73, right. So my first was $500,000, and that's what it took us, well, probably 7-8 years to save up for a deposit.
Yeah.
My wife and I had the market. I'm a Gen X guy, so I remember we were looking at a house in Mount Gravatt, Capellabar Road. Yeah. And it was like $135,000. Thousands, it was 1,200 metre square block, right? Yeah. $135,000. And my wife and I, it was about 2001. And we thought, oh, that's too expensive. that's too much, you know. I was still at uni. My wife had a full-time job, nothing flash at the Greenbank RSL. But, we just thought, nah, too much. Now, it's probably one of the worst financial decisions I've ever made. I'm sure that place would be, you know, worth well over five, six times that value now. But, you know, there is that the baby boomer generation have benefited from that wealth increase.
Yeah.
Recent generations finding it hard to buy their own home. And it's one of the reasons I'm passionate about developing the rest of the country. One of the reasons we've got these high house prices, high property prices, is because too much of our population is stacked up in mainly two major cities. Brisbane and Perth a bit to it as well. And therefore, land is scarce. And there's a lot of competition for it, and that pushes prices up.
Yeah.
Whereas if we could get more jobs and development out into country and regional areas, you could give young people a chance to have a good job, get a good wage, as well as afford their own home in a place where land is not as scarce. It's just as beautiful. In fact, I think it's much, much better living in a country place than in a city. We've got public transport and all the rubbish with that.
I feel like I'm sort of repeating a lot of stuff said before. One of the first articles I wrote, actually wrote for the Monthly of all places, was when the first issue of the Monthly, and I wrote a view from a Mungindi roof. And it was about the amount of capital expenditure by governments in 10 square kilometres of that roof. Hmm. And I said, look...
Were you up on the roof when you wrote it?
Well, in my mind... In my mind, I was...
Had you been up on the roof before, though?
In my mind, I was up something. But it was the issue is that your value of your house is a factor of the investment by the taxpayer.
Yeah, that's right.
Surrounds you. I've said if we invested in 10 square kilometres around Dirranbandi, the wealth we've invested in 10 square kilometres around the Sydney Harbour Bridge, then Dirranbandi would have the dearest real estate prices in Australia, without a shadow of a doubt. And it would be a beautiful place to live, Dirranbandi.
Yep.
But when you look at Sydney itself, really it was sort of a miserable piece of coastline which trillions of dollars has been spent on, and therefore you get... Yeah, a very beautiful.
Well, it's got the nice harbour, but look, I take this place, Canberra. I mean, it was sheep paddocks, right? It's a beautiful city. I lived here. It's a great place to live. But the reason property is very expensive here is because there's jobs here, there's income here, and then there's public infrastructure.
The Southwells and the Cameras here, but on the Molonglo Creek. I mean, there's nothing here. There's sheep.
But they built a beautiful lake and all that infrastructure. Shows so what happens. You can do it anywhere. Look at Houston, the US. It's in the desert, right? It's the fourth biggest city in the US. It's lots happened last week, obviously, and some people from outside probably see a bit of that as
what happened
circus.
Last week?
But you weren't here. Well, you surprised a lot of people. I mean, let's just review the week. Yeah. My life's changed a bit, but
I'm sorry, you don't need
to apologise. It's my own call.
Someone's going to suck a bullet. I like to do it myself. I don't like anybody else to take it.
But I suppose one thing is all of the things that were done last week were all to try and advance the issues we've spoken about.
That's correct.
But people probably are interested in what happened in that. So what happened, mate? What went through? Why did you do it?
I didn't call the spill, others did. I've always said that was a prerequisite. I wouldn't call a spill, but if there was a spill, I would stand, because technically after a spill, there is no leader. There is no position. And that, why do you do that? Because we live in a democracy. And in a democracy that has been fought for and paid for with people's blood, which has been debated and absolutely examined to the nth degree, is the best form of liberty a person can have is... In a system of government as a democracy, unless we can discover another one, this is it. And one of the things, one of the articles of democracy is the right of the party to pick its leader. And when you look at it, there should not be a process of restricting access to a vote. When we have a vote down there in the chamber, three people can call a vote. And they ring the bells and they determine which way the vote goes. Mm-hmm. They don't come up and say, well, we're going to have a vote before we have a vote to see how many people want to vote for it.
Mm.
They have a vote, it's over, life
decisions
goes on.
Made, yep.
Decisions made, carry on. Now, there was a vote. There was a spill, there was a vote between myself and Michael. Michael won, I lost, that's it. But that is our right in this nation. That is why we're in this building.
Mm.
If you don't believe in a democracy, what the hell are you doing in Australian Parliament House? Because that's what it's about. Now, Unfortunately, Matt, you lost your job, and that's a huge loss to Australia. It really is. I'm not pissing in your pocket there. It really is. And it really sort of tortured me a bit because I felt that was probably the thing that worried me the most about.
You know, well, you don't need to worry about that. I mean, I ultimately concluded you had to make the right choice, right? Like, yep. As you say, it was a democracy. You put your hand up. I kissed my wife goodbye on Sunday afternoon. And I thought something might happen, but I wasn't aware at all. I mean, yeah. I suppose, you know, people can take this as they see it, but we in the Nationals Party perhaps need to take some lessons from the Labor or Liberal parties about how to run a spill. We don't really coordinate all among ourselves, and it's not about that, right? You put your hand up. So I wasn't. I thought something might go down, but I wasn't sure what would happen.
I found out on Sunday night that shows a lack of maliciousness.
Exactly, right?
There was no grand plan.
And if I was going to do something to help you, I would have done it earlier, but it all happened at last minute. I found out on Sunday night that the spill was almost certainly going to come on, although there was still some uncertainty about that. So I had a long chat with my wife and talked it through, and I felt you were the best person to lead the party, the best person to deliver on all the things we've been talking about for people. When you're a member of a cabinet and you might come to that conclusion, you've got to be up front with the leader. So I had to have that conversation with Michael, and I've got to live with the consequences. That's life. I've been amazed. You know, this shows the disconnect a little bit between what happens here and what happens back where we all live. Yeah, okay, I've taken a big pay cut. It's, 150 grand or so, you can buy me a beer later and make up for it. But down here, the reaction from people is, well, how are you gonna survive? And I'm fine. I've got a good wage, a good salary, and most importantly, I've got to go back to my family.
There's nothing worse than the moanful bitching of politicians, and I think we've all done it ourselves at times. But you listen to it, and you listen to that sort of faux gravitas of someone banging on about, you almost see them, crying tears of blood with a flag wrapped around them, and you just sometimes you wonder about it. I tell you, he's got problems, not politicians. Kids in cancer wards, they have problems. Yeah. That's who's got a problem. Kids in cancer wards, and our job in politics is to make this nation as strong as we possibly can. We all buy the ticket. We all know the risks, and we can't complain about the place where we live, because an article of democracy is not only the challenge of ideas, but the challenge of the personnel who expound those ideas or are supposed to expound those ideas. That's what a democracy is about. And if you can't just say, well, I only want a democracy till I'm there, then I don't want it ever again until I go. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. So, I've got a job to do back as a senator for Queensland, and I'm still filthy with Lou. He's got a pay rise. I've taken a pay cut. Over there yesterday in the House? Maybe.
Well, the best get a pay rise, I believe, is to go to the crossbench.
More staff usually too.
And then things follow up.
More staff to them.
Same deal. Like it's an article of democracy, and everyone said, "Oh, democracy is evil. Democracy is evil. We can only have democracy the way we set it." This is the Parliament of Australia. There are 103,000 people up the other end of the street at the Australian War Memorial with their names, unfortunately, in brass because they died for this nation. And they died for it for a range of reasons, but one of the central reasons they died for this nation is the belief in the form of government, and a government that is identified as being a democracy. And if once you start saying, well, I just, I'm upset about this form of the democracy, well, you're actually saying you're upset about one of the fundamental tenets of our nation. And that's why I don't have this sort of, huge waves of sympathy, and I won't get sucked into that vortex. It is a democracy. We love being part of it. It is an egalitarian society. Australia is so good. Everybody has a chance to be a part of it. It's transparent. Things move on so quick. And that's what happens here. Big issue today. Look, tomorrow it's
kitty-cat. It won't be. I mean, I think the bigger issue here, maybe we'll talk about this in another future episode, because we could talk for a while on it. The big issue here is that effectively Lou has created a new party room. And just to explain to people, it gets a bit complicated with Queensland and the coalition. But I, as a Queensland senator, am a member of the Liberal National Party. There's no... Yeah. separate association organisation called the Nationals Party of Queensland. It used to be, but the parties merged about a decade ago. But when you come to Canberra, there has been no LNP party room, so you split up south of the Tweed into the traditional Liberal and National party rooms, and I've been in the Nationals party room down here. So effectively, Lewis created a new party room. Yep. Now I did mention to him on Sunday night that, well, mate, you know, maybe take a breath and talk it over. Maybe I'll come join you in a few weeks, jokingly. And he told me he's not having any truck with that because he's the leader of the LNP and he's not brokering any challenges. Yeah, that's right. So he's going to put his photo up on the wall. But look, that's an interesting development down here.
I was fully aware of that too. I mean, you know, I'm probably aware of things that, you know, I've been around this game for a little bit. And when Lou said he was in the LNP, it didn't take me long to work out that the LNP actually have more members than the National Party. And if everybody who's in the LNP sits in the LNP and not in the National Party then disappears. And in our 100th year, we will be no more.
Well, and both of us tried to talk Lou out of it, I think. Yeah. I think you said that publicly.
Yep.
Both of us tried to talk him out of it, and partly, at least in my case, because I do want to see the Nationals Party survive. I think it's more important even now that we have this regional country voice down here.
Here's one of the grabs for you. So maybe, just maybe, if Lou wasn't the deputy speaker and now sort of a stronger part of the team, Lou would be in the LNP, and then maybe it wouldn't be long before other people were in the LNP, and then you wouldn't have to worry about the National Party causing you problems because the National Party would be no more.
That's right, because I'm less familiar with the House, but presumably as Deputy Speaker, you take on a less partisan, less political type role, and maybe that will limit the ramifications of this change. But look, I want to see the National Party survive.
That's going to be the headline from your podcast.
I want to see the Nationals Party continue to survive down here. I mean, the thing, I'm a member of the LNP. It's a great party. It's got the most members of any political party in the country, the LNP. But I don't know. Down here in Canberra, having a party room based on state lines, we are a commonwealth. I'm a proud Queenslander. I back their interests, but we've got to work together. And parties, I think, should be formed on political principles and values, not boundaries, not sort of arbitrary geographical boundaries. So look, it is, though, it's an open question now, and as I say, we might maybe talk a bit about that in one of our future episodes.
I think the big issue there is it's just like I have given my interpretation what I believe the National Party believes in, the capacity of someone to transcend through the economic and social stratification of life to their highest level, the person who lives in the weatherboard and iron house. But I think what the LNP has in front of it is, what do they believe in? What is it? What's their...
That's right, like a map out of core.
What's their philosophical core?
Yeah, because the LNP, you just explained, but it has lots of people, well, it has people from the Liberal Party, as a merger, and it represents inner city Brisbane and all those areas as well. It's a different political beast than the Nationals Party.
Yeah, and you can't define yourself by what you're not. I think that one of the most ludicrous things is when people say, well, we're not the Labor Party. Mm. So, well, yes, and neither's a chook, and neither's a tree in a park or a rock or a pebble on a beach. You can't define yourself by what you're not. You've got to define yourself by who you are and what you are.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's what we're trying to do. The other big issue this week, I've got a few more minutes to wrap up on, is coal-fired power. Bit of commentary about that. Lots of people have an opinion on it. This week we, as a government, announced a funding for a feasibility study, business case, into a power station at a place called Collinsville, coal-fired power station there. You and I have been fighting this for a long time. Yeah. I remember Malcolm supporting us to do this way back when, but Malcolm's got a different view now. Finally we've got this over the line. I mean, we might talk about coal in other times, that take another half an hour, but I mean, one thing I think is interesting is we've had a number of people come out and say the government shouldn't be involved in the energy
network.
We've had over time. One of the reasons I'm in the Nationals Party is, remember a conversation you and I had when I first started working for you, driving down to the Dirranbandi Hotel,
where you started propositioning me on the phone,
and I said no, that was a different time. But and then I said, well, I couldn't understand why there was bipartisan support for renewable energy target. It was the worst climate change policy, and you went off saying Ron Boswell hates this, but we couldn't do anything about it. And that's how I got to know Ron Boswell. But, this, we've got into this system. And as John McEwen, our greatest leader of the Nationalist Party, said, John McEwen said, once you start protecting one part of the economy,
you end up protecting them all.
Because let's be clear, the Country Party was actually founded on a free trade basis.
That's correct.
They took free trade policies. The first coalition agreement removed tariffs from hundreds of lines of goods in the 1930s. But John McEwen realised after World War II that we weren't going to win that argument, that the Liberal and Labor parties were locked into protection, that the only thing they could do in that environment is to find protection for the agricultural community as well. And that's what happened. And we're going through the same thing here, where we protected renewable energy. Renewable energy is the greatest protection racket going around in this country at the moment.
Yeah.
It's being protected. It's drived up prices. Yeah. And now we've got involved in Snowy 2 and all these other things.
And it just drives me crazy. One of the things that annoys me is the left always try to create... The good old Jesuits used to say, the person who can define the topic wins the debate no matter what it is about. Once you define the topic, and once you say the definition of the topic is as such, then you've won the debate. Now, what the left have done is they've come up with this term, climate change, global warming. Okay, I've got no problems with it. But what they do is they use that as a preamble for which everything they say after it you must agree with as well. So they say because of climate change, gravity doesn't exist. And they say, well, gravity does exist. And then they go, well, don't you believe in climate change?
Yeah.
So, well, it's just that... It's just that one doesn't relate to the other. Because, you know, and all this sort of preamble has now got us to a position where we have even decided, we've even sit back and we absorb and accept things which are just not true. That is, coal-fired power stations are uneconomical. Bullshit. Well, that's crazy. I mean, what do we think? All the people in China are dopey?
Right. Yeah,
all
right.
The people in Japan
using
are dopey?
Using our coal. Shipping it thousands of kilometres.
You might say you don't like them. You don't like the look of them. You don't like the smell of them. But please don't tell me they're unviable, because they're not. That is a fallacious argument.
Hundreds are being built. That's a totally fallacious argument.
Yep. And then they say, oh, well, renewables are really cheap. And you say, well, hang on. Based on what? Based on, are you giving all the cost of dispatchable power and removing all the subsidisation through things such as renewable energy credits? And they go, oh no, renewable energy credits got to stay. You say, well, you're not comparing apples with apples.
Well, I want to go back to your point about the playing field, if you like, that's established or set up. And you're right, the left try and create this any discussion about climate change on environmental terms and
moral terms.
It's a better way of putting it. Yeah, exactly.
And
it's
a nebulous argument. It's
I don't agree with you that they have won that. They try to do that, but I actually think when we stand up and point out that, well, no, these policies have economic issues, that the priority for our country should be to grow and develop our industrial capacity and be stronger as a nation and keep a manufacturing sector here, keep sustainable, good-paying jobs here. We usually win that debate.
Yeah.
And we've won it over the past decade. Yeah. There's been basically every election since 2010, probably 2007 too, although we didn't win that one, but 2010, every election since then, there's been some debate about a carbon tax, carbon price... what's the best policy to deal with carbon emissions? You know, we've won basically every one of those elections. We half won it in 2010 from remarkable circumstances. Yeah. And so what we've got to stick to here is I don't want to see our manufacturing jobs get shipped to China.
Yeah.
We could meet our Paris targets. We could meet even beat them if we just shipped our manufacturing industry over to China. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, and
I think we should add value here. I think we want to give our young people a chance to work and make things, not just have to have a job in the office
or not doing coffees in a cafe. We're not being honest with the argument either. We say to people, oh, this is our target. If you're going to be honest in that discussion, I noticed that this was edited out of my 60 Minutes interviews, then you have to tell people the full cost. Say, we are going to meet this target, which of, you know, reducing all our carbon emissions. Therefore, we're going to close down these coal mines. Therefore, this money is not going to go to Treasury. Therefore, we will not be able to build that hospital. We will not be able to give you that pension rise. We are not going to have these jobs available. Now, you accept that, don't you? You accept not only that what we are doing, but the consequences of the actions and what is going to happen to the nation. You are willing to pay for that ticket. Because what you will find... Very often, we see that when you say to people, do you want to change Australia's emission profile? Yes. How much are you willing to pay for that personally? And you know what the answer is? Zero.
Not much. Well, that's our first episode done. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll have more episodes soon. So make sure you subscribe on whatever your favourite podcast app is. And if you'd like to suggest topics for us, get onto us, and we've got lots to talk about, so let us know.